Show 6.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 1940s North Carolina has been described by our guest today as a state of hypocrisy. We were rural and traditional, and despite our public schools teaching that all men are created equal, in North Carolina, they were not. White supremacy prevailed. Between then and now, however, the state experienced an evolution. Some would argue it was more like a revolution as we tackled issues like civil rights and student demonstrations and went from a rural, agriculturally based economy to one that is now based on the ability of the state's urban areas to attract educated people for high-tech energy and banking jobs. And somehow we made this journey feeling fewer of the bumps in the road than many of our other southern neighbor states. How did we do it? How did we come so far? How did we build up our educational institutions into nationally recognized places of higher learning and become a major player in 21st century American politics? The answer is through our politics, and how politics worked to create modern-day North Carolina is meticulously detailed in a new book called The Making of a Southern Democracy, North Carolina Politics from Carr Scott to Pat McCrory. It is the work of our guest this hour, Dr. Tom Amon, who teaches political science at East Carolina University, and he joins us from the studios of WUNC in Durham. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mike. I'm delighted to be with you and your listeners. Being mostly in eastern North Carolina and in the Triangle area, I'm a little out of your range, but I hear wonderful things about you as a host and your program from friends and relatives in the Charlotte area.
Well, thank you.
I know a lot of people in the Charlotte area. So great to be with you.
Well, I hope you feel that way 58 minutes from now. Let's just say that. By the way, Tom Amon will be here in Charlotte tomorrow at Park Road Books. He'll be giving a talk about his book and signing his book, and that's at 2 p.m. tomorrow. In this book, you have
written... Park Road also likes for people to have an opportunity to meet informally and just chat, and so we'll be doing some of that, too.
Okay. In this book, you've written about late 20th century, post-World War II North Carolina political history from about 1948 to the present. Why did you choose that period of our history?
I picked that particular period because we had supposedly just won a great victory for freedom, you know, fighting against Nazi Germany, and it was billed as that. And yet, as you suggested several minutes earlier, we were living in a hypocrisy, a mood of hypocrisy in a lot of ways, or that's what it amounted to. Our Constitution said that it guaranteed certain rights, and the 14th and 15th Amendment had said that blacks were now citizens to be treated equally, full citizenship. Our Declaration of Independence said all men are created equal. And this was a time when even though we had entered modern society in a sense, that was not true. We had moved by 1950 into an age where television was moving from a store window curiosity into people's living rooms from Charlotte, Raleigh, Durham, Greensboro. There was direct air service to cities such as New York, Boston, Chicago, Washington. But yet, despite the modernization, we were living in a society in North Carolina and in the South and some border states that was really more akin to the apartheid or total racial segregation found in South Africa and where one race was clearly superior to another in terms of political rights, social activities, even the way people were addressed. It was a caste system, really, within a democratic nation.
And so you wanted to chronicle the change that has occurred since that time. We've talked to some of the other authors of other books about North Carolina, about the modern history of the state of North Carolina. And so there are a lot of books out there that cover this same period. What did you think was missing that you believe your book fills a gap on?
First, let me say that we have a rich tradition of writing on North Carolina, and I have great respect for those who have labored both on general histories of the state and also there's some biographies that are extremely good also. But I think that we needed more emphasis on how the political process had actually helped us move ahead. And one of the themes of my book would be how individuals in the state in various capacities, and I'm sure we'll be getting into those capacities as we go on, have really moved the state forward. And often politics is a dirty word for people, but yet through politics and through confrontation sometimes, we were able to move from a backward society into a society today that's far from perfect, but yet it is a world apart from what we had earlier. And I thought we needed emphasis on this particular period. Mm-hmm. And both some of those who have been celebrated that we hear a lot about if we're familiar with North Carolina history and politics, but also I tried to call attention to others who don't get as much notice. And also, although we're dealing a lot with leadership and politicians, a lot of individuals who did not hold office played a major role too. For example, the Greensboro Four, and one of the members of that group that staged the sit-in at Woolworth's in Greensboro has just died within the last week or so. Mm-hmm. And we're reminded of individuals such as that who did not hold political office and yet were very important in the shaping of modern North Carolina and making the country as a whole something that it wasn't before, that it's become more recently.
You've written extensively on American politics. You teach this at Eastern Carolina University, but I'm just curious. This is so meticulously detailed about the people and the personalities, and it's a history lesson just on what happened during various election cycles that it's like reading a contemporary account of it in the newspaper every day. How much research did you have to do this, given that you teach this subject, and how long did it take you to put this book together?
Took close to a decade from the inception
until right now.
And UNC Press, and it's a great press, great press, and they were very helpful all the way through, but they are really meticulous. And we thought we were just about through with the book, but then the 2012 election was going to be coming up in another year. Said, wait a minute, we need to wait and include that. And indeed we did, and I even sneaked in a few paragraphs to the epilogue about 2013, so we're about as contemporary as can be. But it took a lot of research. Now, I will say that I'm a connoisseur of elections and looking at the details of elections, both in terms of the numbers and the personalities involved. And just as some people would keep up with car racing, baseball scores, records, football, or whatever, I suppose that my great passion would be following politics, what happens in elections, and the people in them. And you mentioned that it really read like a contemporary account, even when going back. Part of my goal was to capture the flavor, one, of the times, and also to capture the spirit and even to some degree psychoanalyze some of the politicians that were playing major roles during this period.
One of the things that comes through loud and clear, and you just compared yourself to somebody who's really into sports and knows all the sports scores and statistics of players, but you know them about the players in politics and about the election details, is that all of us should pay a lot more attention to what you like as opposed to following sports. You have it's more important. You have written about four sweeping...
Well, I'm all for sports, too.
Okay.
But go ahead.
But you've written about four sweeping themes that defined the state during the period that you're writing about, 1948 to 2013. Our transition from a racially segregated society based on white supremacy to one based on participatory democracy, where everyone, theoretically, has voting rights and fundamental liberties. The second theme is the move away from one-party politics with the Democratic Party supreme to a two-party system with competition between Democrats and Republicans, which I want to talk about. The third theme is that elections matter, often a lot. And the fourth is that people make a difference, and often a big difference. And by that, I guess you mean our leaders and some of the people who push our leaders to do things that perhaps they
both
would not
yes.
have done. Yeah. As an example of how elections and people matter, would it be accurate to say that it was the people that we elected that help us move toward that first theme, which was the racially integrated society that we live in now, to a time where we have voting rights and fundamental liberties?
Now, the people in the sense of leaders and leadership or others?
Either way.
All right. First of all, it should be pointed out, and you and I have in the last few minutes, that 1948, 1950 was a different era. But something big happened in 1948. Carr Scott, first name spelled K-E-R-R, but Carr Scott was elected governor. He was considered a reformer in many respects, what we might call a liberal today, one could say an economic populist. And Scott was very progressive, but yet when it came to the matter of race, his official position was that he was for segregation, saying that's the North Carolina way. Now, in fact, after he got into office, very discreetly, he moved to bring more African Americans into the system in a symbolic sort of way and made a few appointments also indicating this interest. But what's important to note right now is that near the beginning and on well into the period we're talking about, Mike, the people who were considered liberals were also self-avowed segregationists. And of course, there were a large number of people who were not liberal who clearly were strong segregationists at that time and wanted to change the system. So there had to be pressure, and it would take that pressure a while to build up. But there was pressure from within, especially from African Americans, and eventually through demonstrations and the federal government response to demonstrations as we went on later into the 50s and into the 60s, the national government started putting pressure on the state too. And so while there were innovative people from within North Carolina, I think we have to acknowledge that they were shoved and pushed to some degree by people from out of the state, especially starting the administration of President Kennedy in 1961.
That whole period from the beginnings of Jim Crow through when the federal government really began to nudge and push and then make it mandate the fact that we had to have integration. When you talk about a segregationist like Carr Scott, like Charles Aycock, like, well, you even mentioned, we're going to talk about this, Terry Sanford, people that we don't think of as being, we think of them as being progressive, and yet you say they were segregationists. What did that mean to them? Did that mean that they didn't believe that African Americans had rights, or did it simply mean that they had rights, but that we needed to be living in a divided society?
Terry Sanford would be a great example, and there are others. First of all, let me say that those people who were for integration or more racial equality at that particular time were often afraid of the response of others, even non-politicians. If you openly advocated integration or the type of equality we have today, you would be criticized, perhaps even ostracized in certain circles. And now I'm talking about just the simple individual and who would take this particular position. But of course, politicians, if they're going to seek elective office, have to think about voters. And so I think it could be fairly said that even back in the 50s, that Sanford was an individual who believed in greater equality. Yet, when a plan was proposed, the so-called Pearsall Plan in the mid-late 1950s, to assure that integration be blocked, Terry Sanford said he was supporting that, saying it's a holding action. That was his private position. His public position
Hold on. We'll get his public position in a second. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Opera Carolina, performing Puccini's Il Trittico, three short operas, including the comedic Johnny Skeeky, tomorrow and the 23rd and 26th in the Belk Theater. For more information, operacarolina.org. Well, the civil rights era was obviously transformative for so many baby boomers and those from older generations, and that's quickly fading into history. The challenge of keeping that turbulent period and the changes it wrought interesting and alive for younger people is being taken up by Taylor Branch. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of a trilogy of books about Dr. King. He joined us a couple of years ago to share the process of framing that era for the 21st century, and he joins us again Monday, Martin Luther King Day, at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, President Obama is set to announce new guidelines for the National Security Agency. A budget deal moves ahead in Congress, and West Virginia residents grapple with a chemical spill.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Dr. Tom Amon, professor of political science at East Carolina University and the author of a sweeping book of contemporary modern North Carolina political history called The Making of a Southern Democracy, North Carolina Politics from Carr Scott to Pat McCrory. He's in town tomorrow to give a speech, give a little talk and meet with people and also sign his book at Park Road Books at 2 p.m. Just prior to the break, we were talking about the fact that there were some people who were considered progressives in their time, who were for more equal rights, but who were segregationists. One of those people, believe it or not, Terry Sanford. And you were saying privately he had one set of thoughts, but publicly, because he was a politician, had to make other statements. I had to interrupt you in the middle of that thought, so go ahead and finish.
Yes. And again, if Sanford had not taken the public position that he did, suggesting that he was for segregation, he would have never been elected governor of North Carolina, and he wouldn't have had that opportunity to serve. That's simply an indication of what the climate was at that particular time. He did always say, even in earlier days, that he was for equality. But again, he, like virtually all other politicians who had any chance of being elected to office, said, yes, I'm for segregation. And one has to keep in mind that in the Democratic primary of 1960, and back then the Democratic primary, Mike, was the real election, that a staunch segregationist, I. Beverly Lake, who had been a Wake Forest law professor, was running against Terry Sanford, and his whole program was segregation, or that was a good bit of it, and suggesting that Sanford and others would be soft on the issue. Mm-hmm. Sanford used this approach. He said, I'm a segregationist too, or I favor segregation. That's the North Carolina way. That's the way that I think most blacks and whites in North Carolina want it to be. However, I do favor equality and educational opportunities for all people. And he also tried to scare people about Lake, saying if he is elected and he carries out positions of insisting that there be no change whatsoever, then we may have a situation like they're facing in other southern states, or like Little Rock, Arkansas had just several years before, where federal troops were sent in by President Eisenhower, Republican president, in order to achieve the integration of the Little Rock Central High School. And the view was that that hurt business tremendously, that individual business leaders did not want to move their corporations into Arkansas because there was a turbulent climate on race. Well, at that same time that Sanford was going in office, places such as Charlotte, Greensboro, Winston-Salem, Raleigh, and Durham were all interested in recruiting outside businesses, and Sanford saying, I'm better for the economy, and if we have a staunch segregationist in there, then that's going to hurt the state as a whole. It's going to hurt us all. So that was the argument he used after he got in office. Then he began very quietly to take steps to achieve more racial equality, and then the civil rights movement in 1962 and 1963 really reached a peak, and that's when pressure started coming from the national government.
One of the things that I think I got from your book is that business calls a lot of the shots, and we've talked about this on this show before, that particularly yes. Setting up a good business climate is one of the things that allowed North Carolina to progress during the last half of the 20th century and into the 21st century. And in Charlotte, when we've been talking about occasionally how we got through the civil rights era, very calmly and for the most part very peacefully, it was because business leaders got together and decided that we needed to do things for to keep things calm to attract business. It was, as we call it here, the Charlotte way.
I have a good example.
Okay. Go ahead.
All right. Go back to 1957.
Okay.
That was the year that Little Rock, which we just mentioned, was under a court order to integrate. And it was, of course, accomplished with violence. It was accomplished as a result of violence. The president sent troops in. Well, at the very same time, there was something else happening, not only in Charlotte, but also in Greensboro and Winston-Salem. Back then, the public schools typically started in September, right after Labor Day. And in midsummer of 1957, one evening, the school boards of Charlotte, Greensboro, and Winston-Salem just happened to meet. In fact, that was not happenstance. It was well planned out, coordination of all three communities. And there were applications pending from African-American students to be admitted in all three cases. Now, the school boards knew, and the business communities backing the school boards knew, that this was a case where there would eventually be a court order. If they turned down these applications, then there would be a federal court order saying you've got to do this. Their feeling was that if they went ahead and accepted some of the applications from African-American students in each of these three communities, that it would perhaps take some of the pressure off from the federal court. Three cities would say, we did this on our own. That was part of it. Mm-hmm. Part of it was because they were foresighted. They knew that change was coming. And as a result, they thought we better go ahead and work toward bringing about this change on our own. And there was a feeling if we do it as a result of a local decision, perhaps the public will be more willing to accept the change than they would otherwise. And so that evening, the summer before, the three school boards met, all three in their individual cities, Charlotte, Greensboro, and Winston-Salem, called a press conference right after their meetings and announced that there had been change, that African Americans, a few, this is very token integration, would be admitted. Okay, come September, Little Rock had the confrontation, the violence, the president sent the troops in. At the same time, the national media emphasized that in North Carolina, there had been a different approach, that three cities had achieved integration voluntarily. Mm. That looked good. And also it accomplished a motive of the business leaders, the idea North Carolina is a more progressive place, it's a more peaceful place, and it's a safer place than Little Rock, or certainly than some of the cities of the Deep South were.
You know, to contemporary people who were not alive in this period of time and who maybe came of age only recently, this is like ancient history. This is something that they really don't understand. Even African American young people really don't understand the struggles that their ancestors went through because they weren't around to see it. They weren't around to see or experience the fire hoses and the police attack dogs and the vitriol being tossed at them by people on the street as they tried to enter these schools. And you point out that I think that we would be shocked by conditions of the 40s and 50s. And I would think it's not unlike the shock that many people feel when they go to see that movie, 12 Years a Slave. We have this picture in our mind of slavery, but when we really see how those people were often treated, we just can't get it into our head how anybody could do that to somebody else. So paint a picture for me of what life was like here prior to all of this progressiveness.
That's a great question, I think, Mike. And you're absolutely right. Young people, I'm with young people all the time and teach about this very subject, and many are shocked. But I think it goes beyond that even. I think that a lot of people who remember segregation, and we remember a lot who do, or we know a lot who do, would be equally shocked just to go back into a particular period that they remember, and yet in a sense, they don't remember. So it's the young people, it's middle-aged people, it's people who actually remember this. But if you were in the typical community then, for example, in Durham, a city considered somewhat progressive by many at that time and now also, you would get on a bus, let's say a city bus, and up in the front there would be a sign, and it was painted onto the front of the bus, and it would say, "All white patrons sit from front to back. All colored patrons sit from back to front." And I remember as a young boy thinking, what do you do if you're in the middle? What happens there? And Rosa Parks eventually indicated what might happen in a situation like that in the case of Alabama. But you had that segregated water fountains. And I remember once we were traveling to the north and had a situation where we were sitting in a drugstore, and at that particular time we were at a lunch counter in Rochester, New York. And as a young boy, I remember my dad saying to me, "Do you notice something here that you don't notice at home?" And what he was pointing to was that there was an African-American woman who was sitting just four stools away from us. Mm. So it was pervasive. Let me say other ways that it was pervasive, too. It was not just by law, but how people were addressed. Blacks were never referred to by whites as sir or ma'am. And so you had that situation. And in titles going even further, for example, the general practice in North Carolina was if there were an African-American woman or man who was a lot older than you as a child, you would refer to the person instead of Mrs. Smith or Mr. Jones, it would be Aunt Katie or Uncle Ben, or something along those lines. And once, again, as a young boy, I'm asked about that. And it was always a vague explanation. And then when I got a little older and this process was going on, I remember saying to a cousin of mine, "I notice you're calling my cousin Jerome." I said, "I notice you're calling her Aunt Katie. I didn't realize Jerome, he was my first cousin. I said, I didn't realize he was our first cousin." And he said, "You don't understand." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And he just said, "You don't understand." And, "Well, what do you mean?" "Well, that's what you say to colored people who are older." And, of course, I understood very well at that point. But that indicates something about what the situation was like and the refusal to use respectful titles like Mr. or Mrs. Some African-Americans who were educators and who didn't have their PhDs were actually promoted by whites in titles to PhDs. The person would be called Dr. or Doc, because people were more willing to address, if they were white and African-American, as doctor or doc than they were to say Mr. or Mrs. or Ms.
Very strange times. Let's move on to one of the other themes in this book. And one of them, and I mentioned it, I wanted to talk about this, was the move away from one-party politics with the Democratic Party supreme to a two-party system where there was competition between Democrats and Republicans. What led to that? And it may be a mystery to people to hear this part of the conversation today when pretty much Raleigh is controlled by Republicans, and it seems to be a one-party state again. So talk to me about how we made that transition, and are we that way today?
This is a long story, but it should be pointed out that up to about the period we were talking about, the main Republican area in North Carolina would have been in the mountains. There were pockets of Republicanism in certain areas, for example, around Asheboro in Randolph County. But most of the Republicans were in the mountain areas of North Carolina, and that was a legacy from the Civil War.
And the Republicans of that day
didn't want to withdraw from the Union, and so they expressed their displeasure by voting Republican because the rest of the state was Democratic. But let's move toward the actual beginning of real strength for the Republican Party. This really started showing itself in the 50s when Dwight Eisenhower, who was a national hero and general, was the Republican nominee running against Democrat Adlai Stevenson. And in this particular case, Eisenhower had a lot of appeal in urban areas. And in 1952, 1956, and 1960, the Republican candidate, Eisenhower the first two times, and then Nixon the third time, running against Kennedy, carried the biggest counties, what were then the biggest counties in the state at that time, namely the counties of Charlotte, Winston-Salem, and Greensboro. And so Charlotte, and I know a lot of your listeners are in the Charlotte area, was leading the way toward Republicanism. What is interesting over a period of time is that Charlotte and the other big cities in North Carolina pretty much remained that way, with a lot of the business people, middle class people, largely voting Republican. But in the most recent elections, we've seen something of a transition, in fact, a major transition. For example, in both the last two presidential elections, Charlotte went for Obama by just about 100,000 votes, precisely 100,000, and virtually every other major city in both the 2008 elections and the 2012 elections voted for the Democratic candidate, Obama, despite the fact that over recent decades, starting with the 50s, they had been largely Republican in their presidential voting.
Is that because voters had changed, or is that because the parties had changed?
The parties have, over a period of time, changed with on social issues, the Democrats being clearly the more liberal party, and certainly since the 80s on social issues, the Republicans have been the more conservative party. But I think there has been a change in the people also. In recent years, you've been getting not only a lot of minorities and African Americans who are very important, other minorities, increasingly Asians and Hispanics, who are voting largely Democratic, and they have certainly made themselves felt in places such as Charlotte, Raleigh, Durham. That's part of it. But there's also a change in the people coming in. A lot of people come into the South, southern cities, especially Charlotte and Raleigh, from the Northeast and the upper Midwest and even the far West now. And it used to be that they were disproportionately Republican, but there's been a big change among a lot of middle and upper middle class people, professional people outside the South. And because many of them are moderate to liberal on social issues, they have over a period of time gravitated away from the Republican Party and more toward either Democratic or unaffiliated status. And now a lot of these same people are moving from, say, Cleveland or the New York area into Charlotte. And so whereas you used to get a lot of conservative Republicans coming in or moderate Republicans, now you're getting more moderate Democrats, former Republicans, people who are more liberal.
Dr. Tom Amon, professor of political science and author of The Making of the Southern Democracy, will continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Donald Hack Diamond, serving Charlotte for over 30 years with fine diamonds, engagement rings, custom design, and jewelry for all occasions. Donald Hack Diamonds, Sharon Road across from South Park Mall, and DonaldHack.com. President Obama is set to announce new guidelines for the National Security Agency. A budget deal moves ahead in Congress. And West Virginia residents grapple with a chemical spill that spoiled their water. A panel of journalists joins guest host Susan Page for analysis of the week's top domestic news stories in the first hour of the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, then the international hour at 11. That's all upcoming. And if you'd like to join our conversation, a good place to start is WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. And we're coming right back.
Three lives can be saved from one pint of donated blood. In partnership with the Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, we're hosting a blood drive at our studios in the University area on Wednesday, January 29th from 10 to 1. To schedule an appointment, go to WFAE.org and click on the events button at the top of the page.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tom Amon has written a book called The Making of a Southern Democracy, North Carolina Politics from Carr Scott to Pat McCrory. It is a meticulously detailed history of how we got from point A in 1948, which was a very different world in North Carolina, to 2013. He'll be in town
maybe
tomorrow.
Maybe meticulous might has a whole lot of flavor, I think, also.
Well, that yes. By meticulous, I mean that you will learn a heck of a lot. I don't mean that it's boring, because it's not. but I mean, you will know. It's like you're there. It's like you're, as I said earlier, like reading the daily paper and being in the midst of events as they unfold with great detail, so you'll know the players. And many of the players have been forgotten. And that's the point of the book, because a lot of these people who have been forgotten played a great role in moving us to where we are today. We were talking before the break about how we moved from being a fundamentally Democratic state to a Republican state, and in between having competition for the first time in a long time between the two parties. But there is this bipolar thing going on here that you pointed out, where we have a Republican state legislature and a Republican governor right now, but Mecklenburg County and I believe Wake County and the urban areas of the state voted for Barack Obama in 2008.
First time.
Yeah, yes. And again in 2012 in many cases.
Absolutely,
And so while other aspects of the state tend to lean sharply Republican, even Senator Helms was a major figure in state politics pushing his party to the right, Democrat Jim Hunt, longtime governor, was a progressive. How do you explain this bipolar nature of the voters here, where they want some Democrats in major positions and some Republicans in major positions? And many of those people are on the extreme ends of the party. Is that what's going on here?
To some degree, I think that is true. And you make a good point that Hunt and Helms overlapped. They were holding office at just about the same time. And so we do seem to have that bipolar nature in North Carolina. We're a very closely divided state in a lot of respects. Now, as for what's going on right at the moment, as you pointed out, the legislature is overwhelmingly Republican right now, and the congressional delegation is. But we have to talk some about the politics of reapportionment. During the entire 100 years of the 20th century, the Democrats had control of the legislature after the 10-year census. We have a census every 10 years, and that's for purposes of reapportionment. And so they more or less drew the districts to the Democrats' advantage, often great advantage. Well, finally, after the 2010 census, the Republicans had maintained or had managed to get control of the legislature, and it was payback time, and they did it very well and drew the districts both for the legislature and for the U.S. Congress in such a way that the Republicans should win for the next decade unless there is some sort of court ruling changing the districts or modifying the districts. And so that's influencing how the vote goes there. Let me point out that at the same time that the Republicans won most of the congressional seats in the state in the last election, that if you add up the total Democratic vote and the total Republican vote for Congress, that the Democrats won 51%. And if you add up the total vote for the state legislature, despite the fact the Republicans, because of districts, ended up with the overwhelming majority, the Republicans only polled, and this is very respectable, they got a majority there, but it was only 51-52% as compared to the overwhelming percentage that they got in the actual distribution of seats once people were elected. And so that's part of it. Something else we should mention is that on a statewide level, the state for a long time, let's say from the late 60s on through the early part of the 21st century, was largely Republican, often very heavily Republican in presidential elections. But as you've pointed out, Barack Obama narrowly won the state in the first attempt to be president, successful attempt in 2008, and he narrowly lost by a couple of percentage points in 2012. And so in statewide races, the Democrats now seem to be very competitive. We've moved from red status in presidential elections to what we might call purple status. And so I think it could be argued that what someone needs to do to appeal to the voters in a statewide election is very different from what one might do in his or her home legislative district that typically is either solidly Republican or solidly Democrat.
Of course, this redistricting, which has had such a profound influence, at least statewide, on the legislative side of things, happens every 10 years, and the Democrats did precisely what the Republicans did 10 years prior
did.
To that.
No question about that.
But that's what one of the reasons elections matter, isn't it?
Yes. Especially the election every 10 years. But they matter in a lot of other ways.
Oh, sure
they
do.
For example, if Dr. I. Beverly Lake, the segregationist I referred to earlier, had defeated Terry Sanford in 1960 for governor, North Carolina might have taken a very different course from what it did. Elections also matter because Jesse Helms in 1972 was able to be elected to the Senate, hotly contested contest, and Jesse Helms then became one of the leaders of the conservative movement, not just in North Carolina, but he became a major national figure and played a major role in pushing the Republican Party in a more conservative direction, and certainly was someone who was partly responsible for Ronald Reagan becoming president and certainly had great influence over Reagan. So Helms was an extremely important figure in not only North Carolina history, but also in the evolution of the Republican Party and conservatism in the country as a whole.
And another good example of how elections matter is the person you almost begin with in this book, and that's Carr Scott, who in 1948
yes.
won the Democratic gubernatorial primary and gave progressive forces in the state a boost, which led to a domino effect that pushed the state toward where it is today. Talk about that.
Yes. It certainly did. He had an influence on Terry Sanford. In fact, Terry Sanford really got his political start in the Carr Scott campaign. And many of the liberals really traced their political heritage back to that, the development of their attitudes, their socialization, going back to Carr Scott. But let me mention that following Carr Scott, you did have governors who were more closely tied to business, William Umstead and Luther Hodges, and they were more conservative in a sense, but they were also individuals that were very concerned about the North Carolina image and wanted to build North Carolina in a lot of ways, and especially Hodges, who one might say was a business-oriented conservative, played a tremendous role in building North Carolina what it is today. And certainly he was one of the creators of the Research Triangle Park, which has had such an impact. And he was a pace setter not only for governors in the South, but all over the country. Before that, governors had not spent much time recruiting industry, but Hodges did. So the point I'm making is it was not just the more liberal individuals such as Scott or Sanford that played a role in the building of North Carolina, but many business-oriented conservatives, and Luther Hodges, a prime example in the 1950s, also played tremendous roles in pushing the state forward.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but Kerr Scott's victory led to the appointment of Frank Porter Graham to the U.S. Senate and then to another election that put a conservative in office and set up the battle lines that still influence the state today. Is that correct?
Yes. Famous election. Very famous election. There was a vacancy. The incumbent senator died. And Scott, in what was in a sense a daring move, but yet it was one that was initially politically popular, appointed the much-loved president of the University of North Carolina system, as it was constituted then, Frank Porter Graham, a historian and a great humanitarian, to the United States Senate in 1949. And then the election that came up in 1950, because Graham was so highly respected, he was expected to win. But Willie Smith, who was a very respected individual, ran for it, and he saw the only way he could win was to run on segregation. And so he made segregation the big issue and suggested that if Graham were elected, that that would pave the way for racial integration in North Carolina. Jesse Helms was very active in that campaign. That's where he cut his political teeth. Terry Sanford, of course, was very active in the Graham campaign, and so many modern liberals and conservatives, again, cut their teeth in that area. Smith won. He upset Graham, and he won on the issue of segregation. I don't think he really wanted to make segregation and white supremacy his major platform, but he saw that that was the only way he could win. He did pull it out. Smith pulled it out. And that's an excellent illustration, Mike, of what the climate was like. And we were talking about that earlier. And unless you were considered reliable by white segregationists, white supremacists, then you could very well have difficulty being elected. And that is an excellent illustration of it. Highly respected man, liberal though he was, Frank Porter Graham was defeated because he was considered soft on the racial issues.
There are a lot of people in your book, so let's talk about a few of them and spotlight a few of them before we run out of time here. Terry Sanford, you call him one of the 10 greatest American governors of the 20th century, not just in North Carolina, but nationwide. Why?
He's been rated that way, yes.
What made him so?
I think because he was in his own way, and he was cautious in many respects, but at the same time, he was daring. He was paradoxical in a way. But part of it is because he paved the way for integration. Beyond that, he continued what Hodges had done, a more conservative figure in the area of trying to promote business, bring business into the state. And perhaps most of all, he was a great innovator. Sanford was a great innovator in education, both elementary, secondary education, and higher education. And he pushed this forcefully. He was not a charismatic individual. If you just heard him speak, it sounded a lot like this. I believe that quality education is the most important issue facing the voters of North Carolina.
Not electric.
So, not electric at all. It was not Ronald Reagan. It was not Franklin Roosevelt. But yet, through his skills and through the force of his personality and his willingness to be daring, he had tremendous impact.
What?
I think this shows that you don't have to be charismatic to have tremendous impact on the state level.
I'm going to ask you a trick question. What impact did his campaign jingle have? And I ask, it's a trick question because I understand you have been known to sing that jingle in other interviews.
I will do that. And this will give you a little more of his voice. I was not going to do that today because I was afraid some people might be listening. But his campaign jingle was, "The man on the go for the state on the go, that's Terry Sanford. There's a new day coming, so for your next governor, vote for Terry Sanford." This is Tara Sanford. I believe that quality education is the most important issue facing the voters of North Carolina today. If you vote for me, Tara Sanford, I assure you that quality education will be my top priority, and we will achieve quality education in the state of North Carolina. There's a new day coming, so for your next governor, vote for Terry Sanford.
You needed the jingle so you wouldn't vote for Tara Sanford. You would vote for Terry
yes,
Sanford.
Good point. Good point.
One of our listeners, Jim, on Facebook, would like you to talk about the late Senator Sam Ervin, who everybody knows because he became to national importance during the Watergate hearings in the 1970s. Talk about him because I didn't know this until I read this from you, that he, although he helped bring down Nixon and he was a Democrat, he was also a segregationist who wanted to block Martin Luther King Day.
Segregationist indeed, and a very staunch one. He became something of a hero for liberals because he brought down Nixon, who many liberals considered almost satanic. And so Ervin becomes a hero for liberals, not only in North Carolina, but all over the country at that particular time. But he, like so many of the people of his generation, was a segregationist. And just to show that this remained, and he reconciled himself certainly to integration in the later years, no question about that. But when the Martin Luther King holiday was considered, the leading opponent of it in the Senate was Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina. Well, one of his chief allies was Senator, then former Senator Ervin, and I was told by people on the Helms staff that virtually every day that Ervin would call up Helms thinking of new strategies to block the Martin Luther King holiday. In fact, called him so much that finally Ervin's staff, actually Helms' staff, told Ervin, the senator is unavailable. We'll take your message, but he's on the floor right now or whatever. And so that indicates something about his views.
Tom Amon is a professor of political science at East Carolina University. His book is a meticulously detailed and entertaining and interesting look back on the history of the modern history of North Carolina, The Making of a Southern Democracy, North Carolina Politics from Carr Scott to Pat McCrory. Thanks for the hour.